desert, heart, fire. Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and you are listening to the Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya in tribute to the Egyptian goddess, a mother, healer, and warrioress, archetype for contemporary women's empowerment, who will be discussing at great length tonight with Professor Candace Cant, one of the editors of the anthology Heart of the Sun, an anthology and exaltation of Sekhmet published by Goddess Inc. Then in the second half of the show, a women's empowerment continues to be the theme as Vicki Garrison, formerly of the Quiverful movement associated with Dominionist Evangelical Christians, tell us what it was like within the movement and why she's no longer a member. Well, remember to listen every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific to catch the show. You can always catch it here live or any other show later from the archives at your convenience. And now you can also hear the show via iTunes as well. So if you can't tune in live and have questions, please remember you can always email those questions several days before the show. And thank you for your input and feedback. Your comments and suggestions are always welcome. In fact, many of my guests are on the show because listeners like you have written me and said you'd really like to hear me interview a particular person. So stay tuned. Call in if you like. And if you're listening live to 718-766-4662, I'm going to save my announcements for the bottom of the show so as not to keep my first guest, Candace, waiting too long. But stay tuned in with me till the end of the show because I'm going to suggest how you can be a fly in the ointment of patriarchy, especially if you live in the L.A. area. Also, before I forget and before we get started, I can imagine there are a lot of Sekhmet devotees out there listening to this interview. I'd like to invite you to watch the video I made on Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary, which can be found on YouTube. You know, you can probably find it by searching Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary once you get into YouTube, but you certainly can find it if you go to my website, KarenTate.com, and then within the pages there, I think you can find it from different places throughout my site. I think one place would be either the index page or the home page or the contact / meet Karen Tate page. You'll find the link that'll take you directly to Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary on YouTube. I'd love to hear what you think. I think you'll be very surprised when you see Our Lady of Tenacity manifested in all her glory, which is a contemporary name a sister priestess and I have given Sekhmet to add to her plethora of other glorious names she's accumulated throughout history. And I think you might be very surprised at what she looks like. So I'll just dangle that carrot a little bit and tempt you to go take a look at the video we made. And stay tuned in with me, too, because throughout the show I'm going to treat you to more wonderful music dedicated to Sekhmet. The next piece I'm going to play is by Abigail Spinner McBride. And if we have time, I'll let you hear the whole Sekhmet mix by Zingaya. But now to Professor Candace Cant. I don't want to keep her waiting any longer. Let me read her very interesting bio in her own words, or at least excerpts from it. Candace says she's a retired professor of history, having taught at the College of Southern Nevada in Las Vegas for over 30 years. My primary teaching responsibilities at CSN were the U.S. History Survey courses and Nevada history. As I gained seniority, however, I was able to develop and offer more specialized courses. I created such courses as History of Witchcraft, Goddess Traditions, Introduction to Modern Western Paganism, and Modern Paganism second thought. Although my supervisors raised their eyebrows, they couldn't argue with the enrollment figures. The course is repeatedly filled to capacity. I also offered Wiccan Mysteries and the Goddess Path in our non-credit division. When I retired in 2008, my colleague awarded me with the title of Emeritus, and I continue to offer several classes per year at CSN. I've also been fortunate to be able to teach through Cherry Hill Seminary. I offered Intro to the Goddess Path in the fall of 2009, and I'm offering it again this fall, beginning October. This is the fourth week. This is a four-week class designed to familiarize the student with practices of the Goddess Path and the theory behind the practice and the process identifying what differentiates the Goddess Path from other pagan paths. The course also looks at ethics and values from a goddess perspective. I plan to offer a graduate-level Goddess Traditions course in the near future. Candace goes on to say her specialized courses reflected her heart. And 40 miles north of Vegas in Cactus Springs, is the Temple of Goddess Spirituality dedicated to Sekhmet. The temple's been around since 93. She's been a devotee of Sekhmet and associated with the temple for over a dozen years. She was initiated into the Goddess Path there, crowned and ordained in 2007, and Ann Key, who was at the time the resident priestess, invited her and several others to be temple priestesses. So here we have both a scholar and a practitioner, obviously, listeners, just the best of both worlds. And now she's in a new enterprise, a publishing company with Ann Key called Goddess Inc., and their motto is Books for the Heart and Mind. And we're discussing tonight the latest book that they've put out, an anthology called Heart of the Sun, an Anthology and Exaltation of Sekhmet. So, Candace, thank you very much for your time tonight.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, Sekhmet is a pet subject of mine. She's one of my favorite goddesses. I give her credit for teaching me that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
She does have that capacity, doesn't she?
Well, she does. You know, and at the time you're maybe going through these life lessons, you wonder if you're going to make it. But when you come out the other end, you know, you're a different person. You're empowered. I think you know an awful lot more about yourself, and you're certainly a more capable woman out there in the world, I'd say.
She is, I think, a transformative goddess. If you work
Absolutely.
With her, yes, if you work with her, invoke her, she will change your life. There is no question in my mind.
Well, you know, let me tell you what somebody told me a long time ago when I was a newbie, and I didn't know much at all about her, but, you know, I knew there was this goddess temple, not so far from L.A. that, you know, you couldn't drive to it, and so I told some of my goddess friends that I was going to be heading to the goddess temple soon to visit Sekhmet, and I heard this, oh, no, you don't want to do that, you know, that's way too scary, she's just a scary goddess, and you might be sorry you went. Have you ever heard that sort of thing out there? And if you did, what would you say if someone had that impression?
Oh, you know, I heard it before I first encountered the temple. I heard that same expression from people, you know, over the past 12 years. I continue to hear it today. And I think that it's from the myth about her that is most well known, which is the myth, I believe it's called the destruction of humanity. But if you read the myth closely, you understand that what is being communicated there is not a frightening lesson. It is actually a healing lesson. Sekhmet is a healing goddess, and her priestesses and priests in ancient Egypt were the physicians. And when I hear that, I try to explain to people that they need to look a little deeper into the myth. And that's one of only three myths that we know about her, too.
Well, and, you know, and really that look a little deeper, I think we could all benefit from that. There's lots we need to look a little deeper. And for listeners who might not be familiar with Sephmet, I'm sure you're probably referring to the myth where she goes on the drunken rampage and tries to, you know, and there's, you know, she's trying to avenge her father because people have disrespected him or something to that effect.
Right. Humankind has become rebellious. And so she is called upon. It's interesting that when the gods get in trouble, they always call upon a goddess to bail them out, right? she is called upon to fix this. And she goes, rather on this rampage. And they realize that if left, you know, like this, she could destroy everything. So they concoct a number of barrels of beer, I think it is, that is dyed red to look like blood, and they leave that. She drinks that, and she becomes inebriated, passes out, and when she wakes up, everything is normal again. She is back to normal.
So tell me what you know. Now, I mean, I've always and I'll admit, when I heard that story, being a feminist, I interpreted it as maybe a patriarchal take on female power. That this was trying to, you know, more about, you know, the you know, fear of women's power, and that's what we were seeing in the myth. But you have a different idea what the myth is.
Well, no, I don't think that you're entirely, off base there. I agree with you, because I believe that she was sort of taken over by patriarchy. That myth only appears in one place, and it's on the tomb of Seti the First. And he was sort of a warlike pharaoh. But that is the myth that keeps getting replayed over and over and over again. It may have more to do with the power of the sun, the sun's power, the scorching sun of the desert, and how, you know, at certain times of the year it becomes almost, well, very destructive. You live in the desert, certainly in the deserts of Egypt, and then at other times of the year it is much more benign. So I see that in it, and I see with the barrels of beer colored red, anything that has red liquid to it, I wonder what that has to do with menstrual mysteries.
Well, in how though do you see it as, you know, if you, like you said, if you look deeper, how do you see it as a healing myth? I'd like to understand that so that, you know, I can share that as well.
Well, I think Sekhmet was called upon to heal the problems of humankind, which she did. And she is a goddess that doesn't, she's a very active goddess. She doesn't leave things undone.
Oh, so in other words, okay, tell me if I'm understanding you right. When she, we heard that, you know, because humankind was, you know, not, respectful to her father Ra, you know, she goes on this rampage. But what you're saying is if we look deeper, and there's also, you know, maybe this is how it was interpreted from the from the language, too. I mean, it could be a language issue as well. But what you're saying is you think maybe she was trying to write humankind so that they were, doing the right things in life and a healer that way? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think, too, that her rage was directed towards people who were evil doers.
Ah, okay.
And I think when you look at, in the broader picture, look at all the names that are associated with Sekhmet. She is the one who holds back darkness. She is protectress of the divine order. She is the great one of healing, the dryer of tears. You know, the lady of transformations, the guardian of the gates. You see just a different side of her than you see in that one myth that is found in only one place.
You sure do. Well, and also, too, it's been ages since I've read the myth, but I was under the, you know, you've sort of clarified something for me, because I was under the impression that the rampage was against humankind as a whole, not just sort of the evildoers. So if it really was just the evildoers, well, she was just trying to write things.
Well, of course, remember, and of course we do deal with translation there. The problem was that humankind had become rebellious and had disrespected. They were doing bad things.
Whatever that was.
Whatever that was, we don't know.
So now you said there's two other myths. Can you briefly say what the other two myths are? Because there's not that much out there on Sekhmet.
No,
am I correct?
There's very little about there in Sekhmet, about Sekhmet, I'm sorry, that's out there. And what is out there tends to be in languages that are not English. There's a French dissertation, and there is a German book. There is a myth that about the eye, and Sekhmet is called often the Eye of Ra. There are several goddesses that are called the Eye of Ra. And the Sekhmet myth and the Hathor myth often sort of blend into each other. But in this one, the eye goes away, and she has to be brought back. And she goes to I always get my directions in Egypt mixed up, okay? But she goes to the south.
Okay.
And she yes, and then she has to be brought back. And that, I think, is pretty clearly a myth having to do with the sun, when the sun is going away and then needs to be brought back. Okay.
Okay.
And then there is another myth having to do with her status as the Eye of Ra, in which she was replaced, and she was very sad about that, and so she was brought back and she was placed on her father's head, and with a new status, and then she was comforted with that.
Okay, and well, and just a little bit more for listeners who maybe are just hearing about Sekhmet for the first time. Her husband was Ptah, the builder god. Her son is Mehes, and he's another healer. I think he's the patron of doctors, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Doctors,
yeah,
and healing are very much associated with the Sekhmet story.
Well, yeah, I mean, so she's very much a goddess of duality. You know, she's destruction and healing and creativity all in one. It seems. Just to get all of this sort of historical and academic stuff out of the way, can you explain a little bit about how she's connected to Hathor? And I think it's Moot.
Well, I'm not really an expert on Egyptology, but I do know, I mean, the myth, the destruction of humanity is a myth that is also told about Hathor. And sometimes you hear people say that Hathor became Sekhmet, or Sekhmet was the expression of Hathor's rage. So there's just kind of this morphing into each other. And then Moot is the ancient mother goddess. There is a possible relationship there, but I don't know exactly what that relationship is.
Because sometimes she's depicted with the lion head too, isn't she?
There are six or seven different Egyptian goddesses that are depicted with the lion's head.
Okay. Well, you know,
yeah,
the way you just described Hathor and Sekhmet, you know, that Sekhmet is an aspect of potentially Hathor's rage, it sort of reminds me of Kali and Durga.
Yes, it's very similar to that.
Yeah, and here you have
Kali springs from Durga's forehead.
Yes, yes, and here you have another very misunderstood goddess, Kali. I think Sekhmet and Kali are sisters in that. You know, they're very much feared, very much understood, misunderstood, and really unjustly so. You know, because when you start to look at Kali, you know, you think about when the British, you know, had their empire in India, and you know, and how, you know, the thuggies and you know, all of that that was associated with Kali, because they simply didn't, you know, in their Judeo-Christian attitudes, they just didn't, you know, stop to understand what she was really all about. You know, how powerful and important she was.
And Kali is just loved immensely by her devotees.
She is
not in any way seen as an angry or harsh goddess.
Right, right. Well, now
although,
let me ask
although
you,
she can be a tough love goddess.
A tough,
tough love.
Well, and don't you think maybe to a certain extent Sekhmet is too?
Absolutely. Tough love,
yeah.
Transformative. Let me do just a little bit better job with the other two myths, because people really don't know them, and I think I can do it fairly quickly. Is that okay?
Sure, yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, well, one of them, from the book of Smiling Down Apophis, the eye leaves Egypt and follows the deities Tefnut and Shu, and upon her return, the eye is enraged to find that Atum-Ra created another eye to take her place. Her tears of rage and grief form human beings. Atum-Ra then places the eye on his forehead as the uraeus ruling over all. So that was one. Then the second one that's often referred to as the distant goddess.
Well, but I want to punctuate something there.
Sure.
Her tears created human beings.
Her tears of rage and grief form human beings.
That's
something.
That's incredible. That's awesome.
Isn't that?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. The second one, the distant goddess. The eye leaves Egypt and goes south to Nubia. Ra realizes that he is powerless without the eye, so he sends an emissary to convince the eye to return. Through much storytelling, cajoling, and charm, the eye is persuaded to come back. And upon the eye's return, everyone rejoices and a great festival is given in her honor.
Hmm.
And now that one reminds me of the Japanese goddess Amaterasu, who was
the
sun goddess and retreated to the cave, and of course everybody had to cajole
her out.
Back out.
yeah, absolutely. You know, when you look at some of these myths, there's so many similarities, you know, like the Demeter Isis myth, the Amaterasu Demeter myth. It's so much fun, you know, to really delve into all of this. But let's jump ahead to contemporary times a little bit. And I want to pick your brain here. You know, having been in the position you're in, doing the anthology, you know, being associated with Sekhmet so long, I wonder if you've heard anything about this. And I've been trying to find this out for quite a long time. I heard that there are still groups of women who were sort of underground in the Karnak area in Egypt that still consider themselves devotees of Sekhmet. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I hadn't. That is fascinating. I would like to search that out myself.
Yeah. I mean, I find it really fascinating, too. And, I mean, I know there's all sorts of rumors that... you know, I know when I was researching her a bit for my Sacred Places of Goddess book, because, you know, I put a couple Sekhmet sites in there. There were stories about, you know, young boys who had done bad things were punished by her. And so people really still feared her, you know, in these rural areas. You know, and anything like that come up for you either?
No, uh-uh.
Okay, well, might just be, what do you call it, urban myth. Well, Candace, one thing that's really curious for me, and I love to, you know, just sort of chew the fat with other Sekhmet, practitioners, the gap between what we can sort of find or prove historically about Sekhmet and how women identify with her today. You know, most of the stuff we find is how, you know, the pharaohs sort of co-opted her as a warrior goddess and that sort of stuff. But, you know, what I know of her, aside from that, is that, you know, women look to her today as an archetype of empowerment. You know, she teaches them to have strong boundaries. They can say no without feeling guilty. You know, while she does sort of teach the hard lessons, you know, she's also teaching women to, you know, find that spine, that tenacity, that strength and passion. Do you have a problem with the disconnect, you know, between maybe what we can find academically and at least how I've come to know her and some of the women that I know look at her today? You know, did I phrase that question, you know,
yes,
sensibly?
Yes, I think so. And you're right. I mean, we don't know a great deal about her academically. and to take you know, what we do know and then move it into the 21st century is somewhat of a challenge. But I tend to think of it in a way that Sekhmet is not confined to the ancient world. She's very much alive, very much a force in the modern world today. In fact, you find her in so many different places. I am always surprised when I find her. And so, and she appears to people. I mean, she's an active, ongoing, developing presence in people's lives, in women's lives today. So, you know, I think as long as we don't take what we have learned in the future, or what we've learned, you know, today in the present, and try to say, oh, this was the way it was in ancient Egypt, but understand that this is the way it's developing now, and this is the way it's in our life.
So it's a living tradition. It's an evolving living tradition is what you're saying.
An evolving and living tradition, exactly.
Okay. Well, now you said that you have found her in different places in contemporary, in our contemporary world. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Well, I walked into a little bead shop, for example, in Washington, D.C., and found a little array of Sekhmet statues. I asked the girls in the store, I said, you know, are these popular? She says, yeah, we can't keep them in stock.
Do you know she's at the Getty Museum? Not the Getty Museum.
Uh-huh.
Oh, let me take that back. The guy who owned the newspaper up in Northern California.
All I can think of is Hearst.
Yes, that's what I meant to say, Hearst Castle.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes, there are statues of her in the garden at Hearst Castle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you can add that to the list, and there's a wing dedicated to her in the Rosicrucian Museum in San Jose.
Perfect, wonderful. She's also she's in a museum in Baltimore, Maryland, and of course she's in the British Museum. I saw her there.
And she's in the Vatican Museum too. They have lots of them out in the garden, in the Vatican Museum.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, you know, I know, I think it was Robert Masters talked about some of the statues of Sekhmet being essential statues. And I think he meant by that those statues actually contained her essence. Would that be correct?
I believe that is what he is indicating in his book. The Egyptians had a ceremony, and I don't know a great deal about it, but it was the opening of the mouth, in which they would call for the essence of the deity to come into the physical expression of it, and I think that that's what he's talking about.
Okay. Well, you know, a friend of mine who's a Sekhmet priestess had an experience in Egypt where she believes that she actually saw Sekhmet's head move. You know, it was a split second, but, you know, she believed maybe she had stumbled across one of those essential statues.
Wow.
Well,
she's not alone. There's an article, one of the articles in the book by Hank Wesselman talks about a similar experience.
Oh, I've interviewed Hank. Yeah, we talked a good bit about his experiences at the temple in Karnak. So listeners, if you're into Sekhmet, go back through the archives, look for Hank Wesselman. But Candace, for my listeners who are new to Sekhmet, tell them about how the temple out in Indian Springs came to be, the Genevieve Vaughn story.
Sure. Genevieve Vaughn was... born to a fairly wealthy Texas family, and I believe it was oil money. And so grew up with a rather privileged life. Her story is a fascinating one. She married an Italian man, an Italian philosopher, and moved to Italy. And they wanted to have children, but she was unable to become pregnant. So one time they were on vacation in Egypt, and I believe they were in Karnak, and she saw a statue that's kind of back out of the way. People weren't paying much attention to it. And she asked the guard, or the tour guide, well, who is that statue made of? What is that? And he said, well, that's Sekhmet. And if you will put your hands on the statue and ask for what you want, she will grant it to you, and then you should make a promise to her. So she went to the statue, put her hands on the statue, and asked for children. And she said, if you give me children, I will build you a temple. I will build you a Taj Mahal. Well, before she left Egypt, she was pregnant.
Sekhmet couldn't resist that Taj Mahal promise.
That's right. Sekhmet works very quick. You know? And it was a little girl, and Genevieve eventually had two more girls. And then as time went on, she and her Italian husband divorced, and she had returned to the States, and she became very active in the anti-war movement. And she was here in Nevada, in southern Nevada, protesting the test site, the nuclear test site. And she realized, she was remembering and feeling that she had not fulfilled this promise. But she became aware that there was some land available, not terribly far from the test site, and she purchased the land. And once she purchased the land, this is 1992, she then deeded the land back to the Shoshone Indians. This was the 500th anniversary of Columbus, and it was Native American land that she returned to the Shoshone. But the Shoshone agreed that she could build this temple on that land. So in the following year, the temple was built, and if you see a picture of it, it does look like the Taj Mahal. Much smaller, of course. It was built in 1993 by a group of mostly women who called themselves Chaos, and that stood for cooking, housework, and other stuff.
I didn't know this part of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and so it is a kind of an adobe structure, small. You've been there, so you know that. And it's open on the four sides, the four directions. We call those portals to the four directions. And then at the top, there is a copper latticework dome. And the copper tubing that forms that is filled with crystals, so that the energy that we raise there in the temple will reverberate within the universe.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at a picture of it right now with the snow-capped mountains in the background. It's really, you know, it's this this interesting setting of it's like stark beauty, you know, a perfect desert location, I think, for you know, for a Sekhmet temple. Well, in Patricia Perlman, the first caretaker out there, I knew and had visited out there a number of times. In fact, before she passed, she had told me she wanted to do my croning, but unfortunately, you know, she passed away before it was before it was my time. But I remember she was giving me strict instructions when I got my Sekhmet statue that we have in the Sekhmet Mountain Sanctuary. She said, Karen, make sure when you place it in its spot that it's not near water. I'll never forget her telling me that. Don't put her on water. I guess she'd make steam, that fire and water mix. But well, you know, so you and Anne have put together this anthology of, and again, let me give the title. It's Heart of the Sun, an anthology and exaltation of Sekhmet, and it's just a wonderful collection of poetry, essays, visualizations of people who experience her in their lives, right?
Yes, yes. It's a combination of some academic pieces, but also parts of rituals, poetry, guided meditations, just some personal experiences.
Yeah, well, and we're going to mention this a few times, but let's say right now while we're on the subject, how would someone get a copy of it?
Well, you can go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, or we have a website that is www.goddess-inc.com.
And if they buy it from you, I would assume it's probably better than getting it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or something like that.
Well, I think, you know, it probably doesn't make a great deal of difference where they get it, but of course...
kind of keeps the money in the community, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it keeps money.
And we can always autograph, too.
Okay. Well, now I haven't seen the book yet. You know, I hope to eventually get a copy. But I know just from my own experiences with Sekhmet and sharing with other women, my sense of Sekhmet is she seems to be a character that turns up in a lot of healing and hospital stories. At least that's been my experience. Did you find that when you were sifting through stuff to decide what to put in the book, you know, in the anthology?
Yes, a lot of healing, both physical and emotional healing. And I know, you know, people personally who have, for whom Sekhmet has played a huge role in their process of healing,
mm-hmm.
from a variety of different wounds that they've experienced.
Right. Well, I know when I wrote Walking an Ancient Path, you know, I have several sections. Actually, Sekhmet is pretty prominent. There's a chapter just about her. I talk about, I think, magical things that happened with her. And, you know, and I don't say that lightly. I'm a Virgo, you know. I mean, I'm not one of these people that takes things frivolously or lightly. You know, it has to really, there has to be some meat there, or else I tend to ignore it, and it sort of, you know, goes over my head. You know, Goddess really has to sort of hit me between the eyes with a 2x4 sometimes, you know, for me to pay attention, you know. But, you know,
I know that feeling well. I'm also a Virgo.
Ah.
And I have told people, and I realize that I am speaking to an audience here, but sometimes the goddess has to throw dead birds at me to get my attention.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like these little gentle nudges, you know, we just
yes.
don't get. It's got to be something that really attracts our attention. But, I honestly credit her, you know, to some certain extent, you know, for saving a community from fire. You know, I have a whole story about that in my book. And, you know, people can always say, oh, well, you know what, it was all going to work out anyway. But you know what, when the community came together and besieged Sekhmet, and suddenly after, I'm talking about the day fire that happened a few years ago. It started in September, and it raged for weeks and weeks and weeks. And just as it approached this little town where it was, you know, where there was a population and lives were at stake. And, I mean, it was bad enough that the forest had been burning for 3 weeks. But, you know, we all put our magic together and beseeched her to, you know, here she is, you know, goddess of fire, goddess of the sun. And I have to tell you, within 24 hours of us focusing our intention and asking for her help, the fire had stopped. And Candace, more than that, some of us had envisioned rain. And at a time when this area never sees rain, there was rain. You know, it's like some of these things are really just hard to believe unless you were a part of it. You know, you would think somebody was pulling your leg.
That's right. And once you've experienced that, you just don't question it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can remember sitting at her feet asking her, praying to her for something on a Sunday, and on a Monday it looked like it was manifesting. When you said about Genevieve, you know, was pregnant before she even left Egypt, that she works quick. You know, I guess it's that fire energy, you know? I mean, it just sparks. Well, so how did so going back to the anthology again, and I'll give the title again, Heart of the Sun. I love that you called her Heart of the Sun. Why did you create the book?
It was really a labor of love for both my co-editor Anne and myself. We were both associated with the temple and was a priestess there for 3 years. And I've, of course, been a devotee for a long time. And, you know, as participating in temple rituals and activities, we would encounter some very creative works that people had done. And we wanted to pull them together in a place that would give a much wider audience access to these works so that they could use them in their own rituals and their own devotion to Sekhmet.
Okay. And so now we've said that there's all sorts of different things. I mean, it's sort of, you know, gives a little bit for everybody, you know, the academic, the practitioner who wants to use the visualizations, maybe the artist who has more the mind of a poet. So you've really kind of have a real well-rounded assortment of offerings here in this.
Thank you. We tried to have a variety in there, something that And so that it wouldn't be boring to go through, so that you had, you know, all things of the same type, but just a diverse gathering of views of Sekhmet and of different experiences of Sekhmet. You know, one of the interesting things, I was just Googling Sekhmet on the internet, I can't even remember what I was looking for. I think I was looking for dates of Sekhmet rituals. I came across a poem written by Margaret Atwood, who, of course, wrote The Handmaid's Tale, and it's a gorgeous poem. And, of course, you know, she's a big name, so we found her website and sent off a request, and lo and behold, they actually answered our email, and so actually she didn't hold the copyright on that piece of work. It was held by a New York publishing house, and I would need to contact them. But they would also send a letter stating that they wanted them to give us permission. And so we finally got a letter giving us permission to reprint this beautiful but, you know, really unknown poem by Margaret Atwood. And so it is in the anthology.
Go ahead. Well, I think you were about to answer the question I was going to ask.
Okay. It's just titled Sekhmet, the Lion-Headed Goddess of War.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, there's a couple of pieces in the book that I cannot read out loud without just, you know, blubbering. That's one of them. And the other is a poem by a friend, Vajra Ma, that I've really attempted to read two or three times to audiences and can't even get through it because it has such an emotional impact on me.
Oh, well, Vajra was just on the show a few weeks ago.
She's a wonderful lady. I just love her.
So, all right. So, did you have a? I mean, I'm just guessing here. I mean, and this might not have been it, but was part of wanting to put all of this in this anthology to sort of dispel the misinformation out there?
Well, or just to give maybe people more perspective on Sekhmet herself, to see that broader context, to see all the many, many sides of Sekhmet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, frankly, yes, I'd rather people didn't just automatically put her in one category without looking into it further.
Yeah, absolutely, because, yeah, as we said at the top of the show, there are people who maybe are afraid of her needlessly because they don't really understand, you know, what she's about. I remember an early article I wrote for Circle News, Circle Sanctuary's publication, Patricia Perlman saw, and she wrote me a thank you letter and said, "You get it. Thank you for getting that published," you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, so let's, you know, let's talk a little bit about how you yourself became interested in Sekhmet.
Well, I had, you know, like many people, I was raised with in a Christian background, and at a certain point of my life, it became obvious to me that that really wasn't who I was, and I did quite a bit of searching, and finally decided that my path was a pagan path. I had heard that there was this temple, north of town, and one Friday afternoon, it was actually Imol, February 2nd. And I had nothing to do, so I got in my car and drove out to find the temple. And I found it, pulled up, and there was a man kind of doing some work around the yard. And I asked him if I could go up to the temple and look at it, and he said, sure, it's up that way. And then a dark-haired lady came out on the porch, and she said, yes, but come and see me when you come back. So I went up to the temple, and it was just, I sat in the temple, and I looked at Sekhmet, and I kept thinking, I have seen you before somewhere. I have seen you before. And experienced the ground itself is just so alive around the temple. And I spent probably 45 minutes or so there. And then I came back, and I knocked on the door of the house, and that was Patricia Perlman. And she invited me in, and we had tea and chocolate. And I said, oh, yes, this is where I belong. And I was there ever since.
Yeah, I can understand how something like that would happen. You know, it's just one of those life-changing moments. You know, you cross a threshold, and you know you're never gonna be the same again. You're never gonna go back.
That's
absolutely
right.
Well, now they often have rituals and a festival out there in September. And do you want to talk a little bit about what people can experience if they go out there?
Sure, they've got. In fact, there is a website for the temple, and I believe it is just sekhmettemple.com, all one word. And there is a calendar on that website. But there are rituals for the full moons. There are gatherings for the new moons. Those are women only. But the full moon rituals are open to everyone, and all of the Sabbats also have rituals, and they're open to everyone. We did, when Anne was the resident priestess there, we had three Sekhmet festivals, rather large festivals, and we had them right around July 30th, August 1st, which in Egyptian lore is the time that the star Sirius rises and the Nile begins to flood. And it's also the hottest time of the year here in Las Vegas. But at night, it's beautiful. And we would have several hundred people at those rituals. We haven't done them in the last couple of years. They take a huge amount of planning, but we do hope to do them again in the future.
Well, and if you do, I hope you'll tell me. I especially saw some images of when men and women were at one of these, and Sekhmet was being carried in on a litter. I mean, it was just visually stunning. I mean, it was just gorgeous.
The first time I saw that, I truly felt I had been transported to
mm-hmm.
ancient Egypt. It was amazing. But, you know, the music you played at the opening of the show by
mm-hmm.
Zingaya,
yeah.
There's a part in there where there are voices that say Sa Sekhem Sahu,
right.
which is Sekhmet's mantra. And my voice is one of those voices.
Is it really?
Yeah. We recorded that in the temple at one of those festivals at about 3 in the morning.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. You know, I use any excuse I have to play that music. That cut and the other one by Abigail McBride, I just love those two pieces. And but they're long, you know, so I usually, you know, put them on at the end of the show. But I think before you leave, I'm going to play the rest of that Sekhmet mix as sort of, you know, as our farewell to you, Candace. But, well, tell me, we have a couple minutes left. When you were collecting materials for the anthology, was there anything that jumped out at you that surprised you or sort of stood out for any reason?
Well, I think I can't say I was surprised because I don't know. It just went along with how I viewed Sekhmet, but I was just so pleased with the variety of different views and the way people cherish Sekhmet, the way they hold her in their hearts, and the way they honor her, and the way that she has actually come to them. You know, we had people who wrote, you know, academic works that, you know, could have been very dry, and in the process of writing those academic works, they had a personal encounter with Sekhmet. And Sekhmet then, and these sometimes are kind of stodgy academic types too. And
right.
Sekhmet became a part of their life, and that I found was just so gratifying.
Right.
How much Sekhmet meant to all of these people.
Well, you know, I'll share a little thing with you. A friend of mine went to Egypt, and she, toward the end of her life, she knew that she wasn't long left for this earth, but she knew before she passed she had to go to Egypt. She wanted to visit the Isis temple. In fact, she had dedicated a room in her house to this very elaborate, beautifully decorated temple to Isis that she hand-painted herself, you know, all the wall murals and all of this. But Sekhmet was also very close to her as well. And something happened. She was ill when she went to Egypt, and she made it to the Isis temple, but she was too sick the day that the group went to the Sekhmet temple to leave her hotel. And she said she believed she had one of her first auditory experiences, and because she lay in bed depressed, so sad that here she had come so close but was too ill to actually get up and go to her mother's temple. And she was beating herself up, you know, that she just couldn't physically make it. And she said she actually felt she heard Sekhmet say to her, you are all my daughters. You know, it was as if it was the gist of that. It was something like that. It was it was like the connection with Isis and Sekhmet was such that, you know, the very fact that she had been to Isis's temple, she could consider that she had touched Sekhmet as well. And it was interesting that she had been to the Isis temple in Philae, where Isis is in her warrioress aspect. So anyway, it was just I'm probably not doing justice to the story. This other woman tells it much better, you know, from her heart. But, that meant so much to that woman. You know, here she was ill, and, you know, and there's that caring, you know, that caring, nurturing, mothering aspect, I think, that lives in Sekhmet as well as the warrioress, you know.
That is just such a beautiful story.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Candace, let's see. So folks can purchase this from your goddessinc.com.
Goddess Inc. Uh-huh. There's a hyphen between goddess and ink.
Okay. And so I would encourage folks to try to get it there from you. Now, is there anything that I haven't asked you, you want to make sure listeners know before we, maybe play that Sekhmet mix again in its entirety?
Well, I would just encourage listeners to maybe take a look at our website. That is goddess-inc.com. And we have another book out, too, and that's Desert Priestess, a Memoir, and that was written by Anne Key. And if you're interested in Sekhmet, both of the books are great, but this Anne's is an account of her years at the temple as the priestess there, and it's absolutely beautiful work.
I would imagine she probably has some mystical or spiritual experiences to share in that.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, and, you know, and I think that's so important, you know, for those of us who, you know, come from that Judeo-Christian background. It's really hard for us, I think, sometimes, especially when we're new to this, and to give ourselves permission to experience these goddesses, to accept these mystical, these spiritual experiences as real, you know.
And to listen to them and to trust in them.
Yes. Well, now, you think that Sekhmet has something to say to people in the 21st century. I think that might make a good closing.
Oh, I think so, and she does. You know, she appears today. You know, as I said before, in the most unexpected places. And you know, both Anne and I thought that there seems to be a thirst for Sekhmet energy right now. And if you look around, the environment is endangered. We see corruption at the highest levels. We have these pointless wars going on that could actually lead to total annihilation of humanity. So this is a time when Sekhmet energy is really needed by all human beings to fix this.
Absolutely. Well, Candace, I want to thank you very much, and I want to welcome, I want to invite you, if you want to stay on and listen to the Sekhmet mix. I'm going to play that. It's just a little brief interlude before I get to my second guest, Vicki, who I see is here on the switchboard. So in about 5 minutes, you know, I'm going to start the chat with Vicki, but I'd love for people to hear that whole Sekhmet mix, because I believe it really embodies the essence of Sekhmet, don't you?
I do, too. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it is absolutely beautiful. Well, Candace, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And I'm going to have to get in touch with you to get a copy of that book for myself. I can't not have that. And I can't have my library be without it. That's what I'm trying to say.
We'll take care of that. Thank you so much. This has been such a delightful hour talking with you.
Thank you, Candace. And listeners, I also want to mention to you before I forget that if you go to my website, KarenTate.com, and if you go to the Goddess Store page, just click on the button for Goddess Store, I actually have a meditation, a Sekhmet meditation that you really might enjoy, and it's totally free and downloadable, and I think... you know, I think you won't be sorry if you go there and check it out and you just experience that. I have to say, I think it was sort of inspired by what Sekhmet has meant to me and how she's, let's just put it like that, how she's inspired me. So before we get to our other guest, just this little, this musical clip, Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya. Here we go, the whole clip.
Sekhmet, the desert, heart, fire.
Well, that was Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just can save the world. And you've been listening to Professor Candace Kant discuss Our Lady of Tenacity Manifested, the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, deity, archetype, archetype of women's empowerment. And that theme is going to continue tonight with my second guest, Vicki Garrison. Let me welcome Vicki to the show and thank you for her patience. Let me unmute you, Vicki. Hi, Vicki, are you there?
Hi, Karen.
Well, thank
you
so much. Yes, yes, I can hear you. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. We're going to continue our sort of our overarching theme tonight of women's empowerment and, in your case, how the Quiverful movement really sort of disempowers women because you sort of lived that life for a while. But let me start by sharing your bio with listeners, if that's okay, Vicki.
Yes, that's fine.
Well, Vicki Garrison was once a prominent member of the Quiverful community, a Christian fundamentalist movement that bans birth control and encourages huge biblical families such as the Duggar family of TLC's 19 and counting fame. Vicki Garrison wrote a popular newsletter and homeschooled 7 children. She made waves when she left the Quiverful movement, divorced her husband, and began speaking out against the lifestyle via her website, No Longer Quivering. Vicki has appeared on the Joy Behar Show and in The Secret Lives of Women. She's a well-respected adversary of biblical patriarchy. She started the Take Heart Project to provide support to women and children who are escaping abusive religious movements and to provide the public with accurate, compassionate information on the unique challenges faced by the spiritually abused. How brave you are, Vicki. Let me say that to start with.
Oh, well, thank you. I think it's been more desperation than bravery on my part, but it's been quite a journey.
Well, you know, we were just talking about the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, and she's an archetype for women's empowerment. You know, we sort of look at her as this icon, you know, that women can sort of turn to find tenacity, to find strength, to find the courage that they need to do what they have to do to survive. And I can't help to think that knowing about Sekhmet or not, you know, I don't know if that was something that even was on your radar screen from your background, but you certainly had to find those qualities within yourself to escape, I'd say.
Yes, absolutely. And no, I hadn't heard until just listening to the program previously is just fascinating information.
Well,
but
now let's go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I just said, yeah, it definitely has been a experience where, you know, all of those qualities were definitely needed and were, you know, were there and available to me. Although at the time I really didn't think that, you know, I even had it in me, but then to discover, wow, I'm, you know, way stronger than I could have imagined.
Well, you know, sometimes we call it finding our sacred roar, and I think you found your sacred roar. You're certainly roaring now, Vicki. So let's start with, you know, people who don't even know what Quiverful is. I mean, it's part of this evangelical dominionist movement that Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin are associated with, isn't it? Vicki, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I was saying let's start with what Quiverful is, and my understanding, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. We don't, you know, stand on any, you know, sort of precedent here. My understanding is it's part of the evangelical dominionist fundamentalist movement that Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin advocate.
Yes, it is. It's Quiverful. The Christians who are practicing or who believe, you know, and are adherents of the Quiverful ideal, really just based it on Psalm 127, which says, "Blessed is are like arrows in the hands of a mighty man. So are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who has his quiver full of them." And so the basic idea is just to be open to God's leading in the area of family planning, that you would turn that over to the Lord. And what that basically boils down to is the rejection of birth control. And there's very much a patriarchal element, you know, of the husbands as the head of the homes and the wives as the submissive helpmeet. And it is a subset of evangelical fundamentalism. I believe that it's a growing movement in Christianity. You know, I just feel that there's a lot of conditions right now, especially in America, modern times, that kind of set people up to be drawn to this fundamentalist teachings of Quiverful.
Well, you know, Vicki, that's really what I mean, I want to talk a lot about this, but that's the part, at least at this stage of the conversation, that intrigues me the most. How can a woman find herself wanting to be complicit in her own oppression? I mean, we talk about that on Facebook all the time. You know, those of us who are feminists and don't know anybody who maybe have been a part of this like you, can you help us understand how do you get drawn in and you know, or how can so many right-wing women out there want to perpetuate the patriarchy and instead of fighting for, you know, equality and justice and you know, their own reproductive rights?
Well, I think for myself, you know, I can definitely talk of my own experience. For myself, the whole idea of feminism and just that that freedom to be able to choose for yourself, to be able to, you know, basically have the whole world, you know, of options available. For me, that was very overwhelming. I called it the tyranny of choice because there were so many ideas, so many options, so many things that I could do with my life. And, you know, as a young woman, I really had no idea what. And so there's a security when you can find chapter and verse and say, this is what God wants for my life. And, you know, it's very cut and dry. It's very laid out clearly. And you can say, okay, this is, you know, God's plan for my life. It's the very best thing that I can do with my time and my talent. And so for me, that was really the draw, was just to be able to say, I know this is the right path for me.
I can understand that. That makes sense.
It's almost like making the choice to not have a choice.
Yeah. It's safe. It's safer.
It seems very limiting, but it does. It feels very safe. It feels very secure. It feels very, you know, you have that assurance that you're on the right path.
Right. And so now Quiverful, the name comes from that Bible verse that you mentioned. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like we're hearing a lot about it out there in the news. Where does it come from? I mean, what parts of the country is it? Is it all over the country, all over the globe? You know, tell us more about Quiverful.
It is mostly in North America, and mostly I would say in the United States is where it's really growing and gaining ground, although it is a worldwide movement. One of the prominent magazines that promotes the ideas about Rubies, which is an international publication, growing in Australia, you know, is a large segment. But basically it is being pushed through the homeschool venues, Christian homeschooling. If you go to a Christian homeschool convention, you will find you know, there are booths where they're talking, you know, they're selling curriculum for math, for science, et cetera. But the booths that are really full, where the people are gathering, where the people are, you know, pulling out their checkbooks and purchasing the materials, are the ones that are selling this lifestyle. And what they're selling, you know, basically is this protection for your family, because there's so much fear, especially among the Christian evangelical community. It's a growing fear, this whole feeling of, you know, we're in the end times, you know, we're being taken over by the liberals, we're being, you know, there's so much, there's so much, especially with the politics, you know, it's just, there's this big scary world out there, and it's Satan's domain, and he's out to get you, and the secular humanists want your children, et cetera, et cetera. And when you have that mindset of fear, and you have, you know, you encounter this material, which basically promises, you know, God's blessing, God's protection, you do it this way, you do it God's way, and what you're going to experience, you know, it says, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. Says he will not be ashamed, but will speak with the enemies in the gates. And so, you know, it's basically saying that if you want to have that security, if you want to have God's protection against all the evils of the world, what you need to do is order your family according to God's word. And so they're selling this lifestyle, you know, basically saying, you know, get into line with what the word of God teaches. And when you do, God's going to come and he's going to bless your home. He's going to make things, you know, make your path straight. Everything's going to run smoothly for you. And you can just count on God bringing your family through.
Wow.
And so yeah, it's a lot in the homeschool community. You know, you mentioned when you read my bio, the Duggar family, which is on TLC, is a very popular reality TV show. With it, you know, they just announced that they're pregnant with their 20th child.
That poor woman. I mean, she's a baby factory.
and yet she doesn't see it that way at all. You know, she did an interview for TLC where she said, you know, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for a friend. And so she's willing to lay down her life for her family. In her mind, she is doing the greatest thing, that she, you know, she's following Jesus' footsteps by willing to sacrifice herself and her own life for the good of her children.
But what if she died? I mean, what if her body just couldn't take it anymore and she died? I guess then she would just say, well, it was God's will.
Well, and see, that was my situation, because after my third, we decided that I just, you know, was not cut out for childbearing. I had three very difficult pregnancies. I had C-section deliveries. It wiped me out every time. And so my husband, and my ex-husband now, he wouldn't have a vasectomy for the sake of my health. And, you know, physically and mentally, and just to say, this is enough. This is as much as we can handle. And at that time, you know, and even prayerfully, we came to that conclusion that this was just enough for us. And it was later, you know, within, I don't know, a few months of that decision to have the vasectomy, that we started encountering the quiverful ideals. I read a book by Mary Pride called The Way Home, which is kind of a classic as far as what started the whole quiverful movement. Mary Pride wrote The Way Home, Beyond Feminism and Back to Reality. And in her book, she basically says, you know, that feminism robs women of their true value, because what it does is it wants to deny the very essence of what makes a woman a woman, and that is her womb. And by cutting that off, by rejecting that womb and not accepting the blessings of the womb, that, you know, we're basically cutting ourselves off from God and from his actual eternal purpose for our lives.
So did she think feminists don't have babies?
Pardon me?
Does she think feminists don't aren't mothers and don't have children?
Yeah, she has a very skewed view of what a feminist is. Basically, you know, anything that she's, you know, very much takes the fundamentalist approach to womanhood, and that is, what does the Bible say? And if you look in the Bible and you're searching the scriptures, you're going to find patriarchy, you're going to find prolific motherhood, because, you know, they didn't use birth
because
control
back
then.
Because they didn't have science. They didn't have science.
Exactly. And a woman's value in that culture was in her ability to produce sons. So, you know, that's what you're going to find if you're searching the scriptures for a woman's purpose.
Well, let me ask you this. I wonder if this, you know, if this is a part of it. I mean, maybe it's sort of, you know, not spoken about so much. Maybe it's not in print. Maybe it's just whispered. But, you know, people like Pat Buchanan, who are, you know, he's a pundit that comes on MSNBC. He's, you know, he's pretty mm-hmm. right-wing. You know, he's talking about all the time how, you know, the evils of feminism because, you know, white women aren't having enough babies to counter
mm-hmm.
all of these brown babies that are being born. Is part of it racism, too?
I think there's a very strong racial element in it. There's very much a provincial, you know, it's basically wanting to preserve the white power elite, you know, because it really it is not, I don't know, the way I see it now looking back, I can see that it's just this isolationist kind of protectionism that, you know, we have this way of life and this is what, you know, is really God's way. This is, and we need to preserve it. You know, when they talk about children being like arrows in the hand of the mighty man, you know, I mean, that was arrows or ammunition, and they're talking about this holy war. This is, you know, we're having children in order to produce ammunition for God's war against Satan, and really what it boils down to is everybody that's not like us.
Right. We heard a lot of the anti-Muslim rhetoric from the right, but I think it
mm-hmm.
could very quickly turn, and of course, like, you got the DC 40 movement going on where it's the anti-pagan that has been loud, but not as loud as the anti-Muslim. So, yeah, I think it's important for people to hear that it's, you know, they're sort of fearful of or against anybody who's not like them. Does tolerance not fit into their, you know, Jesus view, their Christian view? How do they get around not being tolerant?
We really scoffed at the idea of tolerance. And, you know, so much of Quiverful is really based in the Old Testament, and of course, there was really no tolerance. God, Israel was God's chosen people, and, you know, if you weren't part of that in-group, then, you know, basically God commanded the Israelites to just slaughter their enemies. There was no tolerance there. And even in the New Testament, then you get into the believers, you know, the sheep versus the goats. There is so much of this dichotomy, this us versus them, and, you know, we're the chosen people of God and everyone else is the enemy. And so you really get into that whole mindset, and there is that just extreme fear that is really promoted. I really think that the fear is the key factor there, that everything and everyone is out to get your children to destroy their souls, basically, to lead them on this path that's going to lead them away from God and into hell for eternity. And when you have that kind of fear, there is no room for tolerance.
That's really sad. I mean, it's really, really sad. All right. So, I mean, you probably know who Frank Schaefer is.
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, Frank Schaefer has been on the show a few times, and for listeners who maybe are new to the show or haven't heard the interview with Frank Schaefer, his family was part of the evangelical elite, and he also has left, you know, this fundamentalist, dominionist Christianity, and, you know, sees, you know, why it's so dangerous, and, you know, speaks to that regularly. He's on Huffington Post. He's got books out. And, you know, when you just mm-hmm. said they're, you know, they're very much old, you know, from the Old Testament. I mean, that's what Frank more or less said too. They have a, I think the way he phrased it is, it's this iron or bronze age mentality that they have, you know, they have not evolved, into the future. And it's so difficult in a way to comprehend. I guess I wonder, how did you get away? And are there other women that are just dying to get away and can't, or is the vast majority just sort of, you know, perpetuating this behind this and really believe it? I mean, can the women really be happy?
When I was practicing Quiverflow, when I was, you know, fully convinced, I believed I was happy. I was wholeheartedly sold on the idea, and yeah, there was a satisfaction to the idea that I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was in the will of God, that I was doing my absolute best for not that I thought that I could do anything for God, but just feeling like I was definitely in his will, you know, that I had discovered his best plan for families, for women, and I was following that, you know, to the best of my ability. I really feel that Quiverful, and I've learned, you know, I've kind of had this confirmed to me through my website, No Longer Quivering, where, you know, I have an opportunity to interact with other women who are coming out of the Quiverful movement. And it's not very common that women will come out. Most of the time they dig deeper, they try harder, they pray more. But the ones who do come to No Longer Quivering, they start reading the stories, they start listening, and they say, wow, you know, this is my situation, and I can see why it's not working out for us. But what I'm finding is that Quiverful really is a women's movement. It's generally the women who encounter these ideas, catch this vision for a happy, godly home, and they bring it home to their husbands, and they're the ones that are saying, you know, listen to this tape or read this book or, you know, watch this video, and basically promoting it and kind of pushing it on their husbands.
Wow.
I have some theories as to why that happens.
Tell me, please.
Okay. I really believe that, especially because patriarchy is a huge part, it's the driving factor behind the whole Quiverful ideology. And the promise there is when you submit to the man, you make him the head of the household. The Bible says, in the same way, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So the promise there is that when you're properly submitted to God, and that means under the authority that God has established over you, and according to this, the scriptures that are used prominently in Quiverful, that would be your husband, and you're submitted to your husband, then what that does is opens up a channel for God to be working in your family. And God, you know, the promise is that God is going to use your submission to really bring out those leadership qualities, to really, you know, make a real man of your husband. And what I found is that when these patriarchal ideas come in to a home where they already have a healthy relationship, where there's already mutuality, where there's already mutual respect and love and, you know, a good functioning husband-wife marriage, what usually happens is the husband says, you know, I'm not really interested. You know, I want a partner, not a doormat. I just, you know, this is not appealing to me. I really want your input. I want your, you know, contribution as a full equal partner. And so in those relationships that are healthy, the whole patriarchy idea is kind of scrapped. It's just not appealing. Mm-hmm. But in a situation where the man has issues, where he's a controller, where he is, you know, maybe has low self-esteem, has real problems with, you know, there are so many just psychological unhealthy issues that are entering into this relationship. And so the woman, she's looking for answers. She's like, how can I live with this man? Mm-hmm. And she comes across the patriarchy teachings, and here's promises from God, you know, you be submissive, you do this, lay down your life, and God promises that he's going to use that to really, you know, work in her husband's life. And so she's like, you know, hey, here's the answer. And the husband is going to see that, and he latches on to the idea that, hey, he's supposed to be, you know, according to God, in charge. He's supposed to be, you know, the head of the house. And he really goes for it because it appeals to his, you know, most base nature.
His nature. And really, and so gives, and the wife finds herself sanction. Worse off. So then the wife
exactly.
finds herself worse off then.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, you know, and I've always suspected, and I really could be wrong, because I don't know if I know any women that adhere to this. I mean, they probably wouldn't tell me if they did. I can't imagine that I actually know one. And
well, I don't think they would comprehend for themselves that's the actual dynamic. That's, you know, hindsight is great. You can look back and you can say, wow, that was totally my situation. We were messed up to start with, and that's why this system appealed to us.
Right.
But when you're in it, no, you don't see it.
Well, do you think it might also appeal to women with low self-esteem, women who maybe don't want to compete out in the workforce, maybe would rather just, I don't know, stay home, let the man take care of everything, you know, who would, you know, would rather just sort of, you know, put it all on him.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Looking for her,
it's an abdication
looking for her white
of responsibility.
Knight. Yes. Thank you. That's
mm-hmm.
that's the words I was looking for. Yeah, I mean, that's what I've sort of suspected. You know, they would rather. I mean, look, my mother grew up. You know, the time my mother grew up. I mean, she wasn't religious or part of a group like this, but you know, she grew up with this mentality that, you know, you get married, you have a husband, you know, he's the white knight, he's going to take care of everything, you know. And
mm-hmm.
and I know what that did for her. Not much, you know. And I just started to think that, you know, maybe some of these women are of that mindset too. You know, they just want somebody to take care of everything, you know.
Exactly. And there's a very strong appeal to that, just to not have to be accountable for the decisions.
Right.
Because, and, you know, like I said, in our modern society, women are faced with a lot of decisions that in past history they really just didn't have to deal with. And so it can be overwhelming. You know, I think that's something that's very important in the feminist movement is, you know, yes, we have these rights, we have these choices, all of that, but along with that, we need to equip the young girls to be able to even cope with that overwhelming amount of responsibility that they have for their lives, because before they didn't really, you know, you can't really say that they were in charge of their lives or that, you know, they were really responsible, but now they have those options and they do have that responsibility, and we need to be able to give them the tools to be able to deal with that.
Right. Well, and so what I'm thinking is some of these women, I think what I'm hearing you say is some of them come to it, you know, after they're married, and maybe some of them are born into it if this is what their mother was doing, right?
Yes, and I think that it's definitely a very different experience for those who are raised in it than for the moms who chose it. Because the girls who are raised in it, you know, they basically have their life handed to them on a platter, all wrapped up in this little neat package, chapter and verse, here's what your life is going to be like. They have no choices. It's already been decided for them.
So now tell me, all right, aside from the no birth control, obviously no abortion, that's not even an issue, I guess, even if rape or, probably even not even a possibility under the circumstances of rape or incest or the mother's health, you can't even do abortion then?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, like I said, with the mother's health, even Mary Pride, who wrote that foundational book, The Way Home, she talks about maternal martyrs. You know, she says we send missionaries out into the field all the time knowing that they're putting their life at risk. And, you know, we don't say, no, you better not go. We applaud them. We, you know, we respect them and we hold them up as martyrs. And that's how we should treat the mothers who are willing to risk their lives for the furtherment of the kingdom of God.
All right. So
and that was the argument that convinced me, you know. And my, you know, I convinced my ex-husband to go and have a vasectomy reversal so that we could continue to have more children. And I had four more after that. And every time I was definitely risking my life. I almost died each time.
Jeez. All right. So what other things? Okay, you have to be submissive to the husband. The no birth control. What other things or women subjected to in the Quiverful movement that, I don't know, I hate to use the word that aren't normal, but, I mean, what word do you use? I mean, how do you, you know, are the things imposed upon women in Quiverful that now you reject? Maybe let's put it that way.
Okay, it's not like there's this package deal that you have to take all of these, but there are definitely a lot of ideals that come along with the Quiverful idea that kind of, once you accept that you're going to leave your family planning in God's hands, basically, you know, not use any birth control, have as many children as, you know, is possible for you, the all of the other elements of Quiverful kind of just make sense at that point, such as homeschooling. And most of the Quiverful people are already homeschooling when they encounter this teaching. But if they're not, homeschooling is the next logical step because that's a way of protecting, insulating your children from the outside world. It's a way of giving you control because if you're going to have, you know, half a dozen or more kids, then you've got crowd control that you've got to consider. And if you, you know, if you expose them to a wide variety of different opposing viewpoints and ideas, then you've got to kind of like keep on top of that and keep them, you know, focused on the Bible. And it's a lot easier if they just aren't exposed to that in the first place. So you can keep them at home. You can say, here's what the Bible says. This is what we believe. You know, this is what's going to please God. And so the control is a huge part of it. Child training, which is very popular among, you know, homeschoolers because the idea of obedience, you know, if you've got a lot of kids, they've got to be well-behaved. You, if you watch the Duggars on their reality show, you know, they have 19 kids on the set of the Today Show when they're announcing their 20th pregnancy, and all those kids are just sitting there perfectly still, perfectly quiet, very well-mannered, well-behaved, smiling. In order to do that, you've got to have some major trial training going on. And so one of the popular books is Michael Pearl's To Train Up a Child. I don't know if you're familiar.
Isn't
that
the one that's in the news now because they're showing where children are being beaten?
Yes, and dying. There have been 3 deaths associated with, you know, where they found that the Michael Pearl's child training materials are in the home. And these families have taken it to the point where their children actually died from that extreme discipline.
And I guess if something happens to them again, we just go. It's the fallback is always, well, it was God's will.
Exactly.
How convenient
and
is that? I mean, that takes total responsibility out of the adult's hands as well, in a way, doesn't it? I mean, it just really lets them off the hook.
It does. It does. I really believe that once you accept that fundamentalist Quiverful ideal, it's like your maturity stops right there. You don't learn another thing. You just don't grow up. You don't take responsibility. You don't, you know, everything is placed on God. You know, God told me to do this. It's God's responsibility. It's definitely a cop out.
I can see
parental responsibility.
Another thing that
is very common would be the courtship idea, where you know you have parent-led matchmaking, not quite arranged marriages, but you know, it's like the father, it's an arrangement between the father of the daughter and the father of the son, where they, you know, basically say these two young people would make a good match, and they, you know, from the minute that they enter a courtship, the goal is marriage, and it's usually a short time period that is very heavily managed by the parents. And so, you know, basically that's another thing that, you know, ensures that your children are going to continue in these ideas and these values, because you match them up with somebody from another family who is also living this lifestyle.
Wow. And so how young do the girls usually end up getting married?
That kind of varies, because I think what happens a lot of times in these families, when you have so many children, I mean, if you watch the Duggar program, you see that the little ones, you know, there's no way that Michelle Duggar can take care of all those kids on her own. And those four older daughters, they are carrying the load in that family. You know, they're doing all the cooking, the laundry, and the cleaning. You know, they even do a huge portion of the homeschooling, the child training. All of that falls to them. And
wow.
So the women who are doing this, who are having baby after baby, that affects their health. It affects their energy level. It affects their ability to, you know, be a good mother. And so they very much have to rely on those older daughters to take up the slack to be able to do that. And so there's not a huge motivation in these families to get their daughters married off. A lot of times, you know, the young men come courting and the parents will be like, well, no, he doesn't, you know, quite meet the qualifications. And so you're finding a lot of these young girls are getting older and they're in their 20s, late 20s, and they still have not found a suitable husband.
So now it doesn't matter.
At home, and they're still under their father's authority.
So I guess between the lines here, I'm reading that love is not really a requirement for the marriage.
No, love is not really considered. There's a strange kind of idea about love. You know, it's like the feeling stuff. It doesn't really come into play as much as it's, you know, love is a choice. Love is a decision. And so, you know, a lot of times the parents will be of the idea that, you know, you get all of these other qualities. You know, you have these character qualities. You have these, you know, is he financially responsible? Is he doctrinally correct? All of this, and if all of that comes in line, then you make a choice to love, and the feelings, you know, that'll come naturally later, supposedly.
Okay.
The idea of romantic love really is just very, very much downplayed.
And so I guess college is not an option.
Not all of the Quiverful families will rule out college, but a lot of them do. It's another, you know, logical step. When you have so many children, you know, especially for the girls, they'll say, well, if your purpose, you know, if your real true calling in life is just to be a mom and a wife, then college is kind of a waste of your money. For the sons, they really, because, you know, how are you going to afford to send so many kids to college? So a lot of times they'll say for the sons, you know, you really need to just learn a trade and be an entrepreneur, and they will encourage alternatives to college education because, I mean, they just don't have the money for it.
Well, and I'm wondering how they have the money to have all of these kids. I mean, all of these people can't be rich.
the Duggar family is definitely not representative because they're making huge money off of that reality TV show that they're doing. The majority of Quiverful families, although, you know, a lot of them are well off because their parents are college educated and they have, you know, upper middle class income. But a lot of them, there's this huge emphasis on frugality. and they, you know, sow everything. They grow all their food. They're moving out into the country where they can, you know, raise their own beef. They're really very much trying to be self-supportive. And so they're very, very much the cheapskates, you know. That's just like when you're looking through the quiverful materials and what's available, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of frugality kind of books that are available to teach you to just get by on a lot less.
Wow. Well, and I'm thinking how much harder a life that is for the women, you know, on top of, you know, the physical demands of, you know, one pregnancy after another, too. I mean, you know, she's out.
The quiverful lifestyle is exceedingly demanding. It is very, everything has to be done the hard way. Everything has to be done the old way. You know, the cooking is from scratch. Even, you know, you get your own wheat and you grind your own, you know, grain to make the bread. A lot of them, you know, even make their own soap. It is whatever they can do to pinch pennies and save money.
Well, and I'm
because,
also
you know, another thing that they really are very convicted of is this idea of being debt-free and not relying on any government handouts. So they will not accept, you know, even in families where they would easily qualify for the government health insurance and Medicaid, they will not accept that. They will not accept food stamps. And so they're very self-reliant because of that.
So there are probably a lot of the people we hear at the Republican debates that are cheering to destroy the social safety net, then the Social Security,
yes,
the Medicare, because they figure, well, if they're going to live lives like that, everybody else ought to too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they believe that that's the prerogative of the church, that the church ought to be providing for the poor and for the widows and orphans. Not that that actually pans out in real life, but the ideal is that, you know, people help people. But and so the government, you know, that's just not their jurisdiction.
Right. Well, let's talk about what caused you to leave and you know, how difficult it is for not just you, but maybe other women to leave, you know, such an abusive situation.
Well, you know, leaving an abusive relationship is extremely difficult, and it's actually fairly rare that a woman will get out. I've heard the statistic that a woman leaves 9 times before she finally, you know, permanently is out. And I've heard from domestic violence workers that, you know, it's a huge number. I don't want to. It seems like it was like 90% go back, that they just
mm-hmm.
don't get out. So it's already hard enough. But if you've got, you know, half a dozen or more kids, you have no work experience because you've been at home, you know, for all those years. You have no income source of your own. I mean, there's just so much to overcome to be able to get out of a situation like that. And so it's actually fairly rare that a woman will even admit to herself that she is in an abusive situation or that her children are in a situation that is unhealthy and that is not really constructive for raising, you know, good functional adults.
And I guess it's out of the question that she would just walk away. I mean, leave the husband with the kids and walk away.
There have been instances that I'm aware of where that has happened. It is very rare.
Yeah.
But I mean,
how did you
don't
want to
walk away from your children. For me, it was a culmination. Like, a lot of things just kind of came together at the same time. I was just physically, I couldn't do it anymore. I just burned out. I mean, I got to that point. You know, my last child was born by C-section. I had 5 C-sections altogether, and my last one, I had a partial uterine rupture, and I couldn't wake up for a month. I mean, just physically, I never recovered from that last pregnancy, and so I couldn't keep on top of everything. I mean, I'm homeschooling, I'm you know, raising all these kids, trying to keep everything together, and on top of that, I had a very high maintenance husband who was, you know, just zapped all of my energy. And I just couldn't keep it together. I was just feeling like I should have been hospitalized, but yet I couldn't just abandon my family. So I had to come up with something. And at that time, I met my uncle, who I hadn't known. It was, you know, just kind of a interesting little situation where I ended up meeting him, and we hit it off. And so we started emailing each other, and he is not a believer. You know, he actually had been the minister of education at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto back in the like early 70s, late 60s. So a very different kind of understanding of spirituality and religion. And so for us to even be in communication, you know, was kind of amazing. But we started writing to each other. And for me, it was an opportunity to start thinking again, to start reevaluating what we were doing, why we were doing it. And I just kind of went crazy with it. I mean, I wrote constantly, and I'm one of those who thinks by writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just helped me to sort things out. It helped me to realize that, you know, what we were doing, basing our lives on this archaic text that, you know, was written for a society in which women were property, children were a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And why were we basing our lives on that? Why were we trying to emulate that in, you know, our modern society? It just didn't even make sense. And no wonder it wasn't really working for us, because my children did not take to the quiverful lifestyle and to the patriarchal teachings. I have five daughters, and none of them liked it.
Good.
Yeah, and I think that was a healthy response. I'm really, you know, when I look back at it, you know, at the time I was, like, frustrated. I was like, why can't my children just love this, like the Duggar kids? I mean, the Duggar girls, they eat it up. They love it, at least on camera, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love the babies. And my kids, they love the babies too, but they didn't want to change all their diapers.
Right. Well, Vicki, I want to give you a heads up. We got about 8 minutes. Time has just really flown. And so I want to cover how you got out and how do you feel different about God and spirituality now and how your life's different. If you can kind of wrap that up in these remaining minutes we have.
Okay. Well, you know, like I said, I just kind of burned out. I decided that, you know, everything that I had based my lifestyle, my beliefs on, that whole fundamentalist approach of taking the scriptures literally and saying this is the word of God and this is how I need to order my life, all of a sudden I just didn't believe it anymore. And so without that foundation, without that purpose, I just kind of decided I just need to do what's going to work for me. And the first thing I had to do was just, you know, the divorce, because I only had so much energy left, and I thought I need to focus that on my kids. They're the ones that I really need to concentrate on. And so I did. I divorced my husband. I put my kids all in public school and just kind of worked on recovery for all of us. And it has been an amazing journey just to see my kids kind of discovering themselves. All of a sudden they do have all those options. You know, they can look at their own lives and say, what do I like? What's my interest? What do I want to do?
And how long have you been
kind
free?
About 4 years now.
4 years. And do you reject the church at this point? I mean, are you able to, is your spirituality intact on some level or?
Not really. It's very triggering for me because I feel like that, you know, so much of the abuse that I, you know, cooperated with my own oppression, and I really feel like that was so closely tied to my spirituality that it's hard for me to even go back and revisit that at this point. I know it's a process, and at this point I'm just like, I don't want anything to do with it.
Well, you know, like many of us, like I'm a former Catholic, we call ourselves recovering Catholics, you know. We go through this phase where we don't want to, you know, you finally get to the point where you separate the spirituality from the institution and all the man-made dogma, and you think, well, you know, like as far as like you can maybe accept the qualities of Jesus without all of the bunk that comes with the organized religion, you know, that just sort of controls
people. Well, see, I'm not even at that point because I feel like Jesus was all about martyrdom, and I did so much martyrdom in my life, I'm like, I hate that stuff now. So.
Well, there you go. That's a fair way to look at it as well. It certainly is. Well, Vicki, so do you think that this Quiverful movement has a big influence on in the church and culture? I mean, are they a big movement or a small movement? I mean, do we need to be worried about the Quiverful movement?
I think although the number of people who actually adhere to it and who actually are living the lifestyle is small, relatively small, but I think it is growing, especially because, like I said, the cultural influences and the fearful attitude that is just permeating the evangelical church at this moment. Although the people who are actually doing it is relatively small, the ideals, the basic premise, I think is really gaining ground.
Do you think Fox News is is a culprit for all the fear mongering they do? Does it just sort of feed into this?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would suspect. Well, Vicki, I am so sorry we are almost out of time. In just the last few minutes, I know we've covered a lot of ground, but is there anything you wanted to share that I haven't really asked you that you think is important for listeners to know?
Well, I just think, you know, one of the most important things that I've learned through this whole journey and this experience is just to, you know, being able to follow what is going to work for you rather than having to have a preset, you know, formula. When you're looking to an outside authority that says, here's how it has to be, I think that is so detrimental to our own personal growth. And that's really what's going to trip us up and stumble us, especially when it comes to family, because people are unique, you know,
yeah.
And people need to be able to adapt. They need to be able to say, this is what works for us, rather than having some role forced on them and say, we have to fit into this, you know, preset model.
Yeah, trying to put a square peg in a round hole. So now, Vicki, how would people reach you or learn more about the Quiverful movement if they were interested?
My website is nolongerquivering.com, or you can even just type in Vicki Garrison and you'll come across the website, and we have contact information there on the website.
And when you left, Vicki, what did you end up doing? I mean, did you have to go back to school? Did you get a job? How were you able to manage it all on your own?
Well, I actually had a home business that I worked that entire time. I don't know how I did all of that and had all the babies at the same time, but I did it. And that helped me to, you know, continue my skills and to be able to it's not like I had to start from scratch, so...
So, are you able to reach out to other women in the movement and help them? I mean, does that happen on occasion, or like you said, it's just so rare?
Well, when we first started the website, it was very rare. We'd get maybe one or two emails from women saying, you know, wow, I'm starting to really question this, and now it's becoming more of a trickle, you know, more of a regular thing that women are writing and saying, you know, oh, I help. I know that I need out of this, and so it is growing, the number of women who are coming out. And it's we have a wonderful support group there through our website and through the Take Heart Project, just to be able to encourage women and just being able to say, been there, done that. You know, you can make it.
Right.
And the women who come out, you know, if anybody can leave an abusive situation, Quiverful women can, because they're already used to a very demanding, very difficult lifestyle. And so they've got the guts, they've got the stamina, and they just do it.
You know, you women are the ultimate multitaskers. You know, Vicki, I don't have enough words to convey to you my admiration. I don't. I mean, you are awesome. I mean, you have been to hell and you survived, and I am in awe of you. I am in awe of you. You are wonderful. Example of the strength and tenacity of women, the courage, like I said, I don't have the words for it. I just want to say I'm so proud of you, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy for you and your family that you know, now you can have a life, and I just think it's wonderful. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, and thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to share and say, you know, here's where we've been. And it's been a journey. It's been an amazing journey. And I'm just really thankful to be on this side of it.
Well, I'm glad you're on this side of it, too. Well, good night. And get in touch with me anytime. If there's any new developments and you want to come back on the show, you're welcome anytime, Vicki.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, listeners, we're about out of time tonight, and I promised I would play Abigail Spinner McBride's Sekhmet piece. So until we go off the air for the next couple minutes, you're going to be listening to Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride. Again, in tribute to the Lady of Tenacity Manifested, the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, the woman's archetype of empowerment.